The army got quite more than one disaster in a day.
Looked bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast. This is episode 017, Military Science Fiction and the Profession of Arms. A little bit of housekeeping before we continue on with this episode, which will be certainly near and dear to my heart, is SOF Week, Special Operations Forces Week in Tampa, will be taking place 5 through 8 May 2025 in Tampa, Florida. I will be attending there all week, and I was hoping to reach out to either my fellow Floridians. By the way, I am an OG Floridian, one of probably 100 in the entire state. I was actually born here in Miami, Florida, and hoping maybe to get some FaceTime, face-to-face, in meet space with listeners and correspondents. So if you happen to be in the area during that week, please drop me a DM or get in touch with me via my email, which is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. Or reach out to me in my Substack. All of these things should be in the show notes. SOF Week, if you've never been, is where thousands of SOF folks, SOF operators, people adjacent to SOF operators, and folks in the industry who all join in Tampa once a year to show their wares, discuss in various forums and classes, and then have the Battle of the Bay outside of the hotel where the conference is sent, where you can watch some of the cool stuff in action. So I hope to see some of you there. Get in touch with me beforehand. We will arrange a rendezvous. I am an alumnus of the 101st Airborne Division, and the 101st Airborne Division Association reunion for 2025 this year will be in Orlando, Florida, and it will be 20 through 24 August 2025. So I will be at those two events this summer, and if you happen to be attending either, I would love for you to get in touch with me, and maybe we can meet in meet space. For those unaware, not only this podcast, along with Chasing Ghosts, in a regular warfare podcast, my companion effort to War Notes, available on your favorite podcast vendor. Most folks listen to their podcasts either in their car or on their phone. I do have a YouTube channel, but I have an Achilles heel on my YouTube channel, and that's that it simply has a picture of me for the entire hour. Most of my episodes are less than an hour, a little over an hour. And that's all you can see. I'm told by all of the YouTube gurus out there that is not the way to do it. I have since purchased the necessary equipment that I'll need to include DaVinci Resolve, which is a video editing software, where I may take the next step and start doing that. I'm also doing that for an associated project first that promises to pay me far more remuneration, which is above the number zero, than I currently make with these volunteer podcast efforts that I do. So stay tuned for that. So science fiction, and military science fiction in particular, has always been a fancy of mine. I'm rather old, and I have been reading science fiction lesser now than before since I was a kid. When I was a kid and into my teenage years, I was pretty much obsessed where I only read science fiction for the most part. I tended not to like fantasy because I thought it was cheating a bit, because magic and talismans that one wore around his neck or whatever the case may be could be used to bypass the hard struggle and failure that usually makes character arcs really interesting in narrative fiction and that type of thing. As I mentioned, I haven't read as much because I'm on a cadence now where I'll read 2 to 3 nonfiction, followed by 1 fiction book. And then I'll go back into that cadence because I could be absorbed by the vast panoply of quality fiction that is out there that I haven't read, or some works of fiction like Dune and Legacy of Heorot, in which I find reading it more than once is rather rewarding. Dune is Frank Herbert, of course, and the follow-on books got worse and worse as they continued on. I think that there were 5 in total that were written by Frank Herbert, and I think his son went on to write a number of them that were fairly explicative of the universe and drew it out, but it never drew my interest. The other one I mentioned was Legacy of Heorot by Jerry Purnell and Larry Niven, and I found that book was very interesting. I found it probably to be one of the most realistic portrayals of a first-use, fit-for-purpose, extraterritorial Earth expedition to colonize another world. Really well-crafted. The world-making was great. The science was believable. The tech was believable. The character arcs weren't cardboard cutouts for the most part. It was fleshed out really well, especially for the main characters. But I started to find myself, especially from my youth, on a trajectory of only embracing hard science fiction, that which Robert Heinlein or Jerry Purnell or Larry Niven or Ben Bova and some other stalwarts of that particular brand of science fiction, which it's hard for me to come up with a definition. I would say that it would definitionally be constrained by physics as we know it, and in the near and intermediate term, physics as it can possibly be extrapolated. For instance, one of the problems, of course, with space travel has always been, how do you get there from here without being cryogenically frozen for hundreds of years to get to the nearest star systems where there is a probability, maybe not of life, especially sentient life on another planet, but the potential for life on a planet where it could be terraformed. Hence, we have wormholes and bohrs, B-O-H-R, which have been used as a simulacrum that authors could employ to get past that particular physics problem where one would find a wormhole within a star system and travel to another star system, which has been previously mapped or not, and you sort of use this magical thinking. I hate to say that when I'm referring to hard science fiction, but anyhow, it insinuates itself into a lot of the literature to make up for the impossibility of faster-than-light travel as we currently conceive it. Now, what I'm currently reading is a series called The Orion War, multi-volume, by Kali Altsoba. Kali Altsoba happens to be the pen name used by Cathal J. Nolan, who has written some really fabulous books. For instance, The Allure of Battle, A History of How Wars Have Been Won and Lost. That was published in 2017. I remember reading it several years ago, and not only was I captured by the depth of his scholarship, his footnotes, I know, I'm a geek, I'm captured by footnotes, but also his keen perception of how moral injury, which means those things that we bring away from having been involved in war as either a soldier or a civilian, that scar us spiritually, emotionally, one can say neurologically to a certain extent. As a matter of fact, at the SOFWEEK conference last year, the Joint Special Operations University brought down some of their scholars and staff to talk to this very thing about moral injury, which just so happened to coincide with a tearful reunion with former Afghan National Army Special Operations Command commandos and SF guys that I had trained back in the day when I was deployed to Afghanistan myself as a contractor up near the Uzbeki border, working out of Mazar-e-Sharif. And that was great that that kind of synchronicity and coincidence could take place. What I love about Kali Altsoba, let's call him Cathal Nolan instead of that sort of rickety pen name that he's taken on, What Cathal Nolan has done in its seven volumes is he has this far-reaching space opera, and yes, I do like space opera, that, as a matter of fact, uses boreholes and wormholes for travel throughout all of these star systems. They're engaged, and I'm not going to spoil it for you, nor provide spoilers, in a fourth Orion war after a war hasn't occurred, the third one, for over 300 years. And there are rough analogs and Easter eggs for military history geeks and military historians that he peppers throughout the entire book that I really enjoyed. The entire story is a rough sideways analog of World War II, where the Russians are treated as their own star system. The Germans and their Japanese allies are treated as their own star system. And the allies are, of course, portrayed. And all three of them, an axis being formed between, in this case, the Russians and the Germans and Japanese, instead of the Russians and the alliance, in order to find out who wins this conflict. So no spoilers of who does that. What I really enjoyed about this particular book series is it's one of those ones that really takes a deep dive not only into the tactics, techniques, and procedures, but the tech. It takes a deep dive into moral injury. It takes a deep dive into some of the emotional tides and shipwrecks and collisions psychologically and emotionally that take place in warfare. So I highly recommend it. I will put it in the show notes. It's probably some of the best hard military science fiction that I have read in a while. And I commend it to your attention. Now, before we get into some specific book recommendations and Kerouac-style streams of consciousness, thinking and elucidating and illuminating on science fiction books, in this case, hard military science fiction books, has the armed forces of the world taken this seriously? Well, I don't know what's happened in the Asian armed forces because I don't speak those languages. I don't happen to know what the Russians are thinking or any of the BRICS countries. I'm very Anglo-centric and English-speaking, of course, so I can only confine myself to what that may be. And there's this organization called the Atlantic Council that in the teens of this century sort of tried to take science fiction and entertain it in a fashion as a conflict futurism tool, as a way to take current thinking and use a speculative means and lens to look 5, 10, 15 years into the future, all the way into 2050. But then again, I offer a cautionary tale here. When it comes to conflict futurism, and I pride myself on being one of those guys who examines that, it would be very hubristic of me to say, this is what war is going to look like in 2050, because I think all my listeners can step back to 1990, and I'll bet none of you would have been accurate in your predictions of how the internet would have changed the world between 2000 and 2005. This is the same Bill Gates, for instance, who said that the internet was merely a fad. So what I discover is that I like to confine myself to 5, 10, 15 years at the most. Even then, at that 10 to 15 year mark, who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what the permutations are going to be? No one in 2000 would have predicted that in the fall of 2020, between Azerbaijan and Armenia, there would have been this clash over the Nagorno-Karabakh, which has taken place for a very long time, and what UAVs, FPVs, UASs, and those kind of things would start to do to challenge the battlefield dynamics that have entertained and horrified soldiers for millennia. And then we fast forward to 25. We are just passing one quarter of this 21st century. And when the SMO, the Special Military Operation invasion by Russia, which they had been warning of for the longest time as a red line since William Burns' infamous cable in 2008, telling the whole world, especially the U.S. and NATO, that the Ukraine was a red line and that any tendering of membership or temptations of invoking membership for Ukraine would lead to Russian military intervention. Well, of course, future past tense, that's exactly what occurred. What we discover now, and I consider myself to be a savvy conflict futurist guy, but nonetheless, I did not predict this or forecast this. If you had asked me in 2020 that in 2025, the news would come out from the battlefield on the Ukraine, and we would discover that 75% or more of the battlefield casualties, both killed and wounded, were the result of UAS, UAV, and FPVs, I would have said, I don't think so. I don't think that's the way it would work, but it is. So I stand corrected. As a matter of fact, I would tell you that most military intelligentsia in the West stands corrected because they didn't see it coming. For those of you who have listened to my Fixing Fight Club series on War Notes, this very podcast, where I took the time to delineate in a very specific, comprehensive, and I would dare say problematic examination of the American DoD and by extension its allies and what tremendous problems they had, here's how I would sum up the entire U.S. military enterprise, and of course, by extension, allies and coalitions that are aligned with it, is that we have the most brilliant, the most expensive 20th century fighting machine on Earth, not fit for purpose for 21st century peer combat. Notice I didn't employ the term near peer because about a month ago, I found that term, that phraseology, to be rather foolhardy and idiotic, because Yemen has proven with no Navy that they can make the U.S. Navy arguably one of the best surface navies, especially blue water surface navies, with an unparalleled and unique mass aircraft carrier capability. Nonetheless, those who have listened to my podcast before know that I am not pleased with the U.S. carrier being the be-all, end-all, and fulcrum upon which the U.S. Navy surface forces do all of their blue water and surface business, because I think that they are the chariot and crossbow of the 21st century. And unfortunately, if we get into a hot kinetic war with a peer-peer competitor like China or Russia, you will discover in the first 72 to 96 hours of carrier operations, that most of those will be disabled and unable to receive or loft aircraft, if not sunk entirely with all souls on board. Now, I happen to think that hard military science fiction has a lot to tell us. I think that one of the things that I was very fond of when I was in uniform, and I would tell my students this, or the formations that I commanded and those that I was in charge of, and on occasion when I gave seminars, when I was teaching young cadets at Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi, what a great assignment that was. I would always tell them that in this profession of arms, in this military uniform profession that we're in, we have this trade secret that we can share with everybody if we wish, but not many people articulate it. And that trade secret is that we have over 2,500 years of a bloodless practicum, bloodless for us, in which we can read what has happened in the past, what has succeeded, what has led to stalemate, and what has led to abject failure, or even small failure. As a matter of fact, it could teach us how to examine chains of events where these mass, complex, adaptive systems known as armies and navies clash with each other in a violent, kinetic fashion. We never know who is going to prevail or what kind of stalemate will come out of that. And because of Clausewitzian fog and friction and what Nassim Taleb would tell us about anti-fragility and fragility and what that does in these kind of martial contests, that we have this opportunity as officers left of bang, and NCOs and EMs left of bang, to read all this stuff that is out there. I consider myself an amateur military historian. I am not a credentialed historian. I am as amateur as most of them that are out there on the podcast. I don't have those individuated ciphers behind my name that talk about all of the university credentials I may have. Thank goodness I'm not a member of the American Historical American Historical Association or the Organization of American Historians, both of which are Marxoid, dysfunctional organizations at the greater history level that have really taken presentism to the limit. Presentism would be that chronological conceit that the moral framework in which I perceive the world today, when I'm looking backward at history as an historian, I can project that back there and look down on them and think unblinkingly that I am so much more morally superior, and simply using that lens to discover why they did what they did when clearly, for a variety of moral, epistemological, and intellectual reasons, that is very bad historiography. So students would ask me, do I read fiction? Well, I do read fiction with the cadence that I described earlier in this podcast. Is there great military fiction out there? Not military science fiction, but great military fiction. Well, there is. I think that those of you who may have gone to West Point have probably read Once an Eagle by Anton Meyer, a doorstop of a book, but highly recommended. Matterhorn, a novel of the Vietnam War by Carl Marlantis. From Here to Eternity by James Jones. And Guard of Honor by James Gould Cousins. I would recommend all four of those as military fiction, not science fiction. So what would be the distinction between military science fiction and military fiction, as I just talked about? Well, you can certainly have military fiction that would not deal with speculation of the future or anything whatsoever. Therefore, it's not considered science fiction technically, which was called scientific romance, by the way, at the turn of the 20th century until it turned into science fiction after the Golden Age beckoned in the 1940s and 50s. So I recommend those books that I just listed as really superlative military fiction, along with, of course, Paul Avalon's Tattoo Zoo, which I did an entire podcast episode on, and I consider that to be my novel from my era in the Middle East, where he covers what happens to an infantry platoon in Afghanistan. Every war comes out with that one seminal text that sort of captures and grabs you by the inside out to really illustrate what happened then in that time and place and what happened in that particular combat theater. Tattoo Zoo by Paul Avalon does that for me. So let's talk a little bit about, can science fiction be used by a formal defense intelligentsia or warfighting environment to hone the craft, to make us better soldiers and practitioners, and by the way, by extension, scholars of warfare? I think it absolutely does. The Atlantic Council tried doing that in the teens. I don't know if they continue to do that. West Point has had a couple of programs. TRADOC has had a mad scientist curriculum where, on occasion, they have used these. I remember reading a book by Jerry Purnell, who's among my favorite hard science fiction authors and military science fiction authors, called Footfall, about an invasion on Earth, and they used a very thinly veiled character in there who seemed to be patterned after Robert A. Heinlein, who he's the author of Starship Troopers. I would consider him to be the godfather of military science fiction in the Western world today. And they were using him during this invasion, the military and defense, to speculate in a red teaming fashion, in a red threat fashion, in a contrarian 10th man fashion. What is red team, in this case, going to do? I think science fiction does that really well when it comes to forecasting and prediction. I think a number of you have read the rather thin novel, Starship Troopers. There was a movie made in the late 90s or early 2000s by Paul Verhoeven on that very thing. And whether you love it or hate it, It is interesting to watch for a variety of reasons. Dune was crafted in the 1960s. And when you read Dune with terms like Fedayeen and other terms that were used in there, clearly Frank Herbert was looking at the Fremen on the planet Arrakis, in which most of the action takes place, as an analog to Islamic forces. I think, like I mentioned with Alt Sabah's Cathal Nolan's book earlier, the novelist in this case has to a certain extent, even though he has these outlandishly or outrageously different characters out of timeline, out of history, ahistorical as a matter of fact, they do try to put in these tenuous connections, as it were, that relates it to experiences that all of us as human beings are acquainted with. I remember being so entranced as a boy reading Starship Troopers and just becoming absolutely obsessed by the idea of power armor and exoskeletons. And again, this shows what can happen when you are doing forecasting and prediction without the knowledge of other technologies that may be beckoning, because fast forward 50 years, and here we are. And when you talk about power armor and exoskeletons, it makes no sense of whatsoever to put a human being inside one of those when robotics and, by extension, UAVs, unmanned ground vehicles, unmanned surface vehicles, unmanned subsurface vehicles, the technology, the AI, the independence, the likelihood of dealing with working in a GPS-denied environment, working in an emissions control environment where, as we've discovered in the Ukraine, if you are emitting at all over any frequencies and the sophistication of the frequency sniffers used by the Red Threat to target those people has become so sophisticated that what's going to happen if you do try to get in touch with higher, or if you are coordinating via radio with men and women who happen to be within meters of you to your left or right? I mean, what's happened now in this first quarter century in the 21st century is that robotics, hypersonics, whether defensive or offensive, and UAVs, UAS, and autonomous targeting, because of the OTA loops and targeting methodologies that are being employed now, that are really compressing timelines to such an extent that it is reaching a point at which human cognition, no matter how ingenious you may be, is probably not equipped to respond in time to threats that are emerging. So while I find it incredibly romantic and interesting to think of exoskeletons and power armor and popping a human in there, and via some of the video games, by the way, I don't play video games, so when I refer to Halo, I'm not referring to it as a player nor the execrable series that was televised, but my own conceptions of pictures and what people have told me, putting human beings inside that armor. I mean, you look at Warhammer 40,000, again, I don't pay much attention to that because I don't play the game. So when you see that, human beings encased in these mobile coffins, I simply don't see that bearing out in the future. Now, Cathal Nolan, in his Orion series, one thing he refers to is that some of that occurs, but in the first years of the wars are fought by bots, bots being a term for non-human martial and military entities, but they run out of them. And after a while, and maybe this is a forecast extension as a result of needing human beings fighting each other, it's human against human. And the scale at which in the Orion War series is measured in the hundreds of millions against hundreds of millions, which dwarfs the millions or hundreds of thousands that have historically been the stage for human warfare up until this point. I happen to think that if we had employed some science fiction and speculative fiction folks who specialized in the military realm at left of bang at the concepts and requirements stage for all of these exquisite platforms, from tanks to powered artillery to ships to submarines and all of this. They could have provided us with a predictive or forecasting framework in which we could have avoided a lot of the problems that we're faced with now, per my previous notion of an exquisite 20th century warfare entity that is not fit for purpose for this century. And we will find that out, unfortunately, probably sometime in the next quarter century. And many Americans and their allies and coalition members will die as a result of this lack of foresight. So I see a lot of merit to reading military science fiction if you happen to be a military historian or conflict futurist like myself, or you just happen to be a person who pays attention to what's going on in the world and you're thinking, well, what will conflict look like in the next 25 years? Because again, if we don't make these considerations and think really hard about them and the connections that go into it and the cavalcades of calamities, if these are not assumed, and all the things that happen, what you arrive at is the actions of a pinball, because you're not making any kind of purposeful or, in my estimation, meaningful contribution in extrapolating what warfare is going to look like in the future. Quarter century ago, at the dawn of the 21st century, I don't think that anybody could have said that the ubiquitous nature of UAVs, FPVs, UASs, and such would lead not only to the casualty numbers that I just mentioned, but would lead to the possibility of foot infantry, light infantry, becoming possibly an extinction event on the battlefield if we were to deploy them. So there's lots of merit, and I do wish of that nearing $1 trillion budget that the American Department of Defense spends every year, that they would devote at least a tiny, minuscule, maybe one or two zeros to the right of a decimal point in having a cell, a futurist cell, whose only job is to consider what is terrestrial fighting going to look like, what is between here and the moon, what is lunar fighting going to look like, and how do we plan for that? And also, and I know this sounds outlandish when I say this, and maybe it exists, but they're behind classification regimes and walls. Is there anybody, one person, a cell, who's considering how to react to the various permutations of an invasion of the planet by sentient warfighting beings? Now, mind you, I want to leave you with this proviso, with that it sounds outlandish. Maybe it sounds interesting to some. I have no idea if we've been visited by other planets, other stars, other realms that are extraterrestrial sentient beings. But maybe the probability isn't there, but the possibility is certainly there. And I do think that that's one reason why many of us consume science fiction, and in my case, military science fiction, because we are sort of challenged. It sort of whets our appetite for, well, what could happen, what would happen, what should happen. I mean, consumption of science fiction movies is off the chart, and there are a variety of great science fiction movies out there that consider the military context. I think The Ends of Tomorrow seem to be a sort of ripoff of The Forever War by Joe Haldeman, in which Tom Cruise played a character who kept being raised from the dead to fight again and again, retaining his memory from each fight, so that eventually he had a very good conscious and unconscious competence of the reactions he needed to make it to a certain place in the timeline. Before we get on with the list of some of the books, military science fiction books that happen to be my favorite, that I would recommend you read. And by the way, I hope that my listeners send me via email or maybe visit my Substack in the comments and tell me your recommendations of your favorite military science fiction books. There's one book and a series of books I want to bring to your attention that harkens to my Chasing Ghosts in Irregular Warfare podcast. And in this case, it isn't necessarily space opera or ship-to-ship fights or anything like that. It's actually a special operations fight. It's an irregular warfare fight, hybrid zone, gray zone, sabotage, what Churchill would refer to as sending his Jedburgh teams and other mischief teams from the OSS and the SOE into Europe during World War II to set Europe aflame, as he would say. That first book is a very thin one. One could call it a novella by Eric Frank Russell called Wasp, 1957. The title of Wasp comes from the idea that the main character's actions and central purpose mimic that particular insect. Just as something as small as a wasp can terrorize a much larger creature in control of a car to the point of causing a crash and killing the occupants, so the defeat of an enemy may be wrought via psychological and guerrilla warfare by small but deadly antagonists in their midst. So I think it's 175 pages, again, published in 1957. You could take an afternoon to read this. What I loved about it is that the guy who goes in there to cause all the mischief and mayhem and set this planet aflame, in this case, Sirius, he is genetically altered. He is altered in the way he looks. And he goes in there with this full tool bag of how to conduct the kind of operations that one would read from the special operations executive in the Office of Strategic Services that I just mentioned that were used during World War II. The second set of books is by one of my favorite hard science fiction authors by the name of Michael Z. Williamson. And there is a book in the series called The Weapon. And in The Weapon, there is a single man, much like in The Wasp, who is sent to a planet to wreak havoc and cause all kinds of problems. In this case, not to be a spoiler, but I guess I am going to be a spoiler to a certain extent, he manages to wipe out billions of people. This is part of his Freehold series. I highly recommend the first Freehold novel by that very title. But in this case, if you're trying to zero in on what would happen if you sent in a very talented man and his small team to wreak havoc, not on a city, not on a state, not on a country, but a planet, what could happen? And of course, this is science fiction, so there are going to be arcs and artistic license that is employed to make the plot work. In this case, it's very compelling. This book follows one Kenneth Chinron through his career as a special warfare soldier with the Freehold of Grain, a colony world that has declared its independence, but whose independence is not recognized by the United Nations, in this case, the UN in space. Anticipating that the UN is going to attack the Freehold, he and his teams of saboteurs are inserted as sleepers into old Earth cities. Once the attacks occur, the agents go to work with infrastructure attacks, devastating the vulnerable Earth society and economy. Eventually, the UN gives up the attack and pays reparations to the Freehold. But the book is filled with a lot. It's very suspenseful. It's filled with a lot of interesting tactics, techniques, and procedures. Very engrossing. And what I love about this is it really embraces strategic compression, where you are taking tactical level soldiery to achieve strategic, and in this case, grand strategic goals. So there are several other books that I think covers the irregular warfare milieu, but we're going to move on to the greater conflict, space opera, mechanical milieu that seems to attract a lot of people. Starship Troopers, I had mentioned that already. Forever War, I mentioned that one about soldiers who are literally rebuilt and reincarnated to keep fighting until, well, until they're told not to. Old Man's War is sort of like that. Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, I recommend it. I read that. Wow, that was a while ago when I read that. There's a movie. I saw the movie. I thought the movie was shabby and shitty. But There's some others like Armor by John Stakely, which covers large armor, to include Hammer Slammers by David Drake. I had mentioned Dune, and I'm probably one of a dozen people who's fond of the Lynch movie from the 1980s. I think that was 83 or 84. And the new ones that just came out, the two-part Dune, I thought it was extraordinarily well done. I thought that was certainly military science fiction and interesting things to speculate and look at when it comes to that. I mentioned Footfall by Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell. Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, he did an entire series of short stories and novellas to include other authors that were, I'll bet it was probably one of the longest running military science fiction motifs in Bain Publications history. Jack Campbell wrote The Lost Fleet, which is naval adventures that are set in space. The Falkenberg's Legion series by Jerry Purnell tended to be infantry-centric, as is the Warhammer universe with Warhammer 40,000. That universe tends to be very infantry-centric. Legion of the Damned, which I really enjoyed, by William C. Dietz. I will put all of these in the show notes for those of you who are interested. John Ringo happens to be a former soldier. His military acumen, his history, and obviously his mastery of how infantry combat works is in a number of books, to include his Posling War series. And he does several books in there. When the Devil Dances by John Ringo happens to be one of my favorites. Look, you've got to know that there's literally hundreds of these books out there. Everybody has their own particular tastes when it comes to this. So you will find those things that really connect with you. For instance, while I like Harry Turtledove, I find for the most part, I have a hard time keeping up with all the alternative history manifestations that he takes on. Now, there is a curious sub-genre of military science fiction. Maybe one could call it adjacent to it, which would be called military horror or apocalypse fiction, most of which involves zombies. I would call to your attention just one particular one by a fellow by the name of Craig DeLuey. Craig and I have corresponded. He has never been in the military. But I think when it comes to small unit combat and an appreciation of military culture, he's right near the top in really having an IQ and understanding of that culture that is not met by his peers. There's one book he read, and it's during a zombie apocalypse, called Tooth and Nail. And I think two accompanying books are The Killing Floor. And what you discover with these is that if you took these and you put them in a position where they are not zombies or post-apocalyptic foes or competitors, but you simply arrayed them against other soldiers or superior forces, everything would fit. Everything would feel real. Everything would be palpably uncomfortable and disturbing. And he really captures that. So shout out to Craig DeLuey to really cracking the code on that kind of thing. I've read some others, but I want to confine myself to military science fiction. I just want to mention that one military horror adjacent category that is there. That seems to be significantly smaller than that of military science fiction. What you'll find with a lot of military science fiction is, I wouldn't say they're all the same, but they certainly share a lot of similar attributes. One is usually acquainted with a soldier who has either been going at it for a while or is just entering service through boot camp, and their character arc is one of struggle and failure and overcoming obstacles and finally finding themselves in the fray, as it were, and doing all those kind of things. And in military science fiction, you will find demarcations into space opera, which tends to be naval combat in space. You will find the ones, like I mentioned with DeLuey, where it's that kind of Black Hawk Down, 13 hours, small unit combat that is visceral and disturbing. Ground combat, like what you would find in Dune and combinations thereof. And from a soldier's perspective or a small company of soldiers' perspective, there's other adjacent deviations within it that characterize, for instance, what Eric Flint has done with 1632 and other novels, where he takes soldiers out of their time and place and puts them in other places, whether it is an alien civilization or back in time to fight with Romans. And he takes the time traveling device to move them there. The usual character arc for all of these is against the most absurd and just absolutely challenging circumstances. You either win or lose. And fortunately, in a lot of these, the character arcs are rather well crafted, and one can identify with them. If you can't identify the character, with rare exception, you're going to lose your reader. So I find those compelling. But going back to that first book that I mentioned by Cathal Nolan, the book series, The Orion War, what I really appreciate about that is that, and he's characterizing technology that we're not even close to, but nonetheless, technology that should be something that we're paying attention to. In there, for a variety of reasons, and the way the world building works, all soldiers down to the atomistic level have sound, color, and invisibility cloaking devices and things like that, so that at the individual level, they can't be detected because there is a certain ubiquity, as we're seeing today in the Ukraine, of UASs, FPVs, UAVs, because the time of sneaking, skulking, deceiving, concealing, those kind of things, I think that is quickly disappearing on the modern battlefield. We certainly saw that in the fall of 2020 in the clash over Nagorno-Karabakh between the Azerbaijanis and the Armenians. And now we're seeing it in spades with the clocking that the Ukrainians are taking, the absolute drubbing that they have taken in the eastern third of the Ukraine. As I have mentioned in previous podcasts, I do think that the Russians are probably the most lethal land army on Earth as we speak. They have a substantial advantage that one finds with the regional hegemon. The global hegemon, that would be the U.S. in this case, is always putting their finger in a dike, whether in a deliberate or hasty fashion. And by the way, there simply aren't enough limbs to do that, so they have to conduct triage all the time. Regional hegemons, in this case Iran, Russia, China, have two advantages over the United States because they are regional hegemons. They don't have to pay for an extensive expeditionary network and capability of exquisite and not so exquisite platforms, and they devote themselves to defense as a means of winning whatever conflict they'll happen to be in, whether it is contiguous or extraterritorial. It's interesting when one considers that an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese, which they have been playing at forever to bring Formosa back into the fold, they have a very sophisticated, wide and deep integrated air and missile defense network, much like what the Russians have. And when you look at this historically, one can go back to World War II and think to yourself that if the Russians and the Japanese, who were at the opposite ends of the spectrum as far as alliance was concerned, signed an agreement early on in the war that they would not go to war with each other, although Stalin would break this after the first nuclear weapons detonated over Japan in August of 1945. what that meant for the Russians and the Japanese, by the way, is they did not have this enormous rear flank to cover so that they could concentrate, have an economy of force, and have mass at just the right places against the active belligerents that they were fighting against. Could Russia have succeeded if they were fighting the Japanese in the east and the Germans in the west? It's problematic. It's counterfactual. But it would have made their job very difficult. As a matter of fact, it would have made their job difficult for this reason. Not only did the Allies during World War II supply them up above Europe proper in the northern reaches and the northern reaches of Europe and the southern reaches of the Arctic, but they also did so over the Pacific. And what if that had been shut down by the Japanese? Because for the most part, the Japanese in the conduct of the war from 1941 to 1945 confined themselves to U.S. and Allied shipping and did not touch Russian shipping unless it was a mistake. So these kind of counterfactuals are also dealt with by a variety of authors out there in counterfactuals about what would happen if Hitler had won World War II, which I see as a distinct impossibility for a variety of reasons. If they didn't have the strategic airlift and sea lift to take on the UK, how could they possibly establish a beachhead, expand a lodgment, and invade the United States with what they couldn't invade the UK with? But nonetheless, we will suspend our disbelief, which brings us to the ubiquitous and prolific Philip K. Dick, the science fiction author who has read, I guarantee you, you can find half a dozen movies that have the Philip K. Dick vibe or they have the Philip K. Dick signature on them. In the screenplay, Man in the High Castle was a speculative science fiction novel that talked about what if the Japanese and the Germans met in the middle of the United States and took it over and occupied it, and what would that look like? So not only are there those scenarios of space opera, those scenarios of going to a planet and destroying it from within, but there's also a whole subgenre within this of how does one best an invasion of either bipedal human creatures or very human adjacent creatures or entirely alien creatures like John Ringo has done with Hell's Fair and others like that. What I really dig about reading these, especially if imagine you're in uniform or out of uniform, or you happen to have a bunch of friends, colleagues, and acquaintances who are interested in the military, this is a great jumping off point. It is a great springboard to speculate what war is going to look like in 5, 10, 15 years. If you really want to go out on a limb, what's it going to look like by 2050 or 2060 or 2070? What will war look like, for instance, if not only do we achieve a kind of suzerainty in low Earth orbit where one or many establish a military parity up there? What is lunar conflict going to look like? Robert Heinlein wrote a book called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, in which he talks about a lunar colony breaking off from Earth and discovering, for instance, that there's lots of rocks on the moon's surface. And when they started lobbing those rocks into Earth's gravity well as a negotiating tool, Earth quickly came to the negotiating table. What does that look like? It is my conceit that, and I am very excited for Elon Musk's ambitions to settle on Mars. I do wish that he would send the DNA arcs and the terraforming preambles up there now, which don't require human beings to be on there yet, and get stuff started. But one thing Musk must know, and I've never seen him articulate this, is that without a mature lunar infrastructure, getting up there will not only be prohibitively expensive to go to Mars, but it will be infrequent compared to a mature lunar base and what that will provide for a very negligible gravity well to escape, along with all the resources, unlimited energy, and possible proximity of asteroid resources to be harvested and motored over to a Lagrangian point either around Earth or a gravity capture point around the moon and start building there, because absent that sophisticated moon infrastructure, I don't think the Mars mission is going to be a success, even though I want it to be. So that lends itself to not only why we should read military science fiction, I urge all of my professional and non-professional conflict observers and military aficionados to do that very thing, but it just provides great talking points and exits off the received wisdom highway that has led America to have, as I mentioned before, this absolutely inadequate force structure to prevail in 21st century peer combat. So I would leave you with this plea is number one, free is plenty of us can talk about this, speculate about this, communicate, correspond, go to my Substack, talk about it in comments. But wouldn't it be great if that $1 trillion budget created a small conflict futurist cell with some terrifically talented military science fiction writers who've been considering this thing for profit and fun their entire lives to help build left of bang, to help develop the requirements, to help form and massage the concepts that we need to have an effective military apparatus for the remainder of this century. I don't know if anybody in the DoD does that. Maybe they do it behind the classification walls. Maybe this is being done in a big way at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. I hope it is. I don't see a lot of evidence in force structure, and I've been watching force structure for nearly half a century. So I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping that in the United States, and maybe Europe and our Asian allies by extension, that there are very sophisticated prediction and forecasting cells that are red teaming in a very comprehensive fashion what war is going to look like, so that we'll be able to face it in a way in which monumental surprise and existential threat won't erase us from the earth. So, thanks for listening. This is Bill. I hope I'm talking to fellow military science fiction aficionados. Your recommendations for great books or even movies, please go to my comments section on the Substack accompanying the publication of this podcast episode and leave them there. If you wish to reach out to me, it is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I would appreciate that if you're listening to this on a podcast vendor and you're really enjoying it, to leave stars and or a review and to tell any interested, you would know better than me, friends, family, colleagues, acquaintances of this podcast. I'd be obliged if you did so. So thank you for listening. This is Bill out.